This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington. Timothy Treadwell loved spending his summers in Alaska. He loved to get as close as possible to wild grizzly bears. Well, there's news today that the author and photographer has died doing just that. Tim Treadwell and his girlfriend, Amy Huguenard, were found dead, apparently mauled to death, in Katmai National Park in Alaska. Late last week, Roy Horn of the Las Vegas Animal Act, Siegfried and Roy, was attacked by one of the tigers in his show. He remains in critical condition. Many people are fascinated with wild animals, but most people keep their interest at a distance. Very few people, however, get close enough to large wild animals to interact with them. Mark Hauser is the author of Wild Minds, What Animals Really Think. He's a professor of psychology and neurosciences at Harvard University, and he joins us from his office in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thanks very much.
So, Mr. Hauser, are incidents like this increasing?
I doubt they're increasing. I mean, I think they're probably maybe more in the news. these things happen periodically. People get curious about animals in the wild and get too close. But I think the thing to sort of keep clear is that whenever you try to have as a pet or as a companion an animal that is largely a wild animal as opposed to a domesticated animal, these kinds of incidences are probable. Not maybe saying highly probable, but they're probable.
Well, there's one thing about controlling a wild ferret, and there's one thing about controlling a wild tiger size.
Well, that's right. And I think, the thing that we've learned is that certainly the process of domestication actually really changes in quite dramatic ways the entire sort of physiology and brains of these animals. And whereas if you take an animal that's a wild animal, even if you rear it from a young age, that's not causing the same kinds of changes in its behavior. It's still a wild animal.
So part of the Siegfried and Roy Act relies on the performer's ability to control wild animals. And to a certain extent, they were able to, but they did have a wild tiger, and one of them got away. I mean, what's the dangers of forgetting that these are wild animals?
Well, I think, the cautionary note, there's a couple interesting things about the tiger. One is that, in some sense, it's really quite extraordinary that they're able to train these animals. And, of course, part of that training comes from working with animals at a very young age. One of the things that's come out from a lot of the zoo reports, of course, is that one of the ways in which you get training of these animals is often through not having them be in the best of conditions. So they're sort of reversive kinds of training methods. But in the end, these animals still have the genetics and still have the physiology of a wild animal, and therefore there are going to be cases in which certain kinds of behavior may trigger certain kinds of normal behaviors for them that may not even be intended to actually hurt somebody, but just as a fact of their power, like with elephants in zoos and so forth, may result in injuries.
So is it ever possible, Professor, to domesticate a wild animal?
Well, that's a great question, actually, because about 30 years ago or so, a Russian biologist by the name of Belayev took wild foxes and, as a project, made the move of trying to domesticate them. And in approximately 30 generations, was able to take a wild fox and turn it into the equivalent of a kind of a Labrador lapping dog. And they now have a whole sort of very large colony in Siberia of these domesticated wild foxes. And the beauty of it is that they show all the signs of domestication in things like dogs and horses and cows. You see this kind of white patch on their forehead, the ears kind of curl down, their brain sizes increase relative to the wild type, they're much less impulsive, much less aggressive. So yes, it's absolutely possible. It's been done as an experiment.
Timothy Treadwell liked to go into grizzly bear dens in the wild. I don't think he was willing to wait 30 generations for something to show up. Why do people believe that they can be safe and go into that situation?
Well, I wonder the extent to which it's whether they believe they can be safe or if there's just the curiosity factor kind of overwhelms us. I mean, I've worked in the wild with primates, with monkeys in Kenya and chimpanzees in Uganda. And, it's inevitable that you're just curious. You kind of you can't help yourself, and you want to kind of reach out and touch them or interact with them. And so I think that curiosity is what kind of propels many of us in terms of curiosity. For some of us, it keeps us at bay, and others, it makes us go further. So I think it's less, I mean, my guess is that it's less that people think that they actually are going to be completely safe than that their curiosity kind of overwhelms them.
So we have our motivations for going into dens or raising 30 generations of foxes, but what's the effect on the animals?
Well, I mean, the effects on the animals, so, I mean, you know, that's a complicated question in the sense that there's many layers to how we affect animal life. I mean, so obviously when we domesticate an animal like a fox, we haven't done that to the entire population. We've taken a subset of the population and worked with them. So on a larger consequence, nothing's happened. But, of course, when you take animals into captivity and you begin to change their genetic stock, there are some negative consequences. And I think a very good case of this is the sort of farm-raised salmon, which has had its complete sort of genome completely changed. And the really bad part about that is that many of those animals have gotten out into the ocean and have now started taking over and outcompeting some of the wild stocks. So that's a very negative consequences of human intervention. So I think it's a mixed story. I mean, you know, we learn an incredible amount about the development and evolution of the brain by a process of domestication because we learn how artificial selection affects animals. And then there are some of these negative consequences which influence things like conservation.
Here's Gerald in Portland, Oregon. Hi, Gerald.
Yes.
Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Hi. I had a question about the fast effects of domestication. You mentioned the Russian scientists raising some foxes and domesticating them, but what you're describing sounded like it was had effects that were amazingly quick. I was asking about about white patches on the foreheads of the animals. Why would those be exhibited, and why those would come up in a small breeding population?
Well, so two things. You know, great question. In fact, it's a really interesting one for many of us who are interested in the evolution of the brain, is that it is striking that you can take a vertebrate, a complicated vertebrate like a mammal, like a fox, and within, you know, approximately 30 generations get this massive change, you know, in brain size, in physiology, in morphology. Now, why that particular white patch comes up is unclear. However, now that people are beginning to map out the genomes of different species, we know what it is. It's called the star mutation. If you look at horses, you'll often see this white patch right on the forehead. So it's something that comes up very, very commonly in domesticated animals. It seems to be something that just as a result of domestication. Why? Completely unclear. But now that these different genomes are being mapped, we can begin to isolate what the effects are and why those particular gene complexes are being affected more than others. But you're right. I mean, it's actually extraordinary that kind of pressure can cause that kind of dramatic change in the brain.
Do people who train wild animals attribute human emotions to them?
Oh, yeah. That's a completely different question. But yes, I mean, I think anybody who works with animals, and so my wife's a veterinarian, and we have lots of animals at home, and I work with animals all the time. And even though in my science I'm extremely cautious about how I interpret their behavior, it's, I think, inevitable that you attribute human emotions to animals. The thing that's changed is that, you know, Charles Darwin was really the one who first began to sort of think about animal emotions in a comparative context, thinking about similarities and differences between humans and other animals. And now the sort of the serious science of emotion has become much more of a popular topic, and people are really beginning to grapple with not just do animals have emotion, which I think most scientists are willing to acknowledge, but what kinds of emotions do they have? In what ways are they same as ours, and in what ways are they different? So I think the question has gotten much more interesting in terms of, well, that dog looks guilty, but actually does it really feel guilty?
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Mark Hauser is the author of Wild Minds, What Animals Really Think. He's a professor of psychology and neurosciences at Harvard University. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.